Coming up on Tech News Today, YouTube promises offline viewing of YouTube videos coming in November. Also, Xbox says we got hundreds of ideas for TV shows for you, and it's iOS 7 Day! Everybody's really excited. All that more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for Wednesday, September 18th, 2013. Also known as OMG iOS 7 is downloading Freakout Day. Tech News Today is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 28 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 25% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code TNT9. And by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be, anonymously and without oversight. For 20% off your new account, go to ProXPN.com/TWIT and use offer code TNT. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Maya Zaktar.
I'm Jason Howell.
And this is the show where, oh my gosh, I'm totally downloading iOS.
No, don't do it. Don't do it.
Oh, slow.
Yeah, it's really it's been a lot since we started the show. Also, we bring you tech news, like the top 10 stories of the day in the news views.
Oh my God, news views.
Oh, don't blow up.
BlackBerry announced a big new phone, the BlackBerry Z30. I'm calling it Z because they're Canadian. It has a 5-inch Super AMOLED display, a 1.7 gigahertz processor, quad-core graphics, a 2,880 milliamp hour battery, and is the first device to run BlackBerry OS 10.2. The device is being marketed to business, emphasizing features like Documents to Go, which comes pre-installed. The Z30 or Z30 hits the UK and the Middle East next week and all other regions during the holiday season.
Want to watch YouTube videos, but finding yourself without an internet connection? Previously, all you could do is cry. But in November, you'll be able to watch offline YouTube videos, as the YouTube team assures YouTube creators in a blog post about offline access. Quote, this upcoming feature will allow people to add video to their devices to watch for a short period when an internet connection is unavailable. So your fans' ability to enjoy your videos no longer has to be interrupted by something as commonplace as a morning commute.
Who cares about YouTube? Let's talk about Hulu. Because Wall Street Journal reports that Hulu and BBC Worldwide North America reached a deal that'll bring 144 different BBC shows to Hulu in the first year of that deal. The agreement includes top-tier programming like Doctor Who and Sherlock. Over 2,000 episodes will hit the video streaming service. The deal is not an exclusive, so you'll still be able to see BBC programming on other services as well.
And who cares about Hulu? Let's talk about the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, huh? Am I right? I'm not right. But that's the U.S. President's Tech Policy Group, and it has submitted a proposal to the FCC suggesting all wireless carriers in the country be required to unlock all mobile devices, phones, and tablets to allow easier switching between carriers. Back in January, the Library of Congress dropped an exemption from copyright law for unlocking phones.
Blah, who cares about politics? Let's talk about Google. Google's got a new plan to cut out third-party cookies from online ads called Ad ID. At least this is according to an anonymous source speaking to USA Today about Google's plans. The proposal could offer more control over which ads are shown to customers and to Google as well. Google's reportedly planning to secure backing from government agencies, consumer groups, and online advertisers.
Yeah, who cares about Google? Let's talk about some real news here. A 23-year-old man was attacked in Colindale, North London. Three teenagers allegedly hit him with a brick, stabbed him, then robbed him of his phone, his watch, and his copy of Grand Theft Auto 5. The attack happened at 1:20 a.m. just after the midnight launch of the game. A Scotland Yard spokesperson said the motive for the attack is unclear at this stage. The victim is in the hospital where he's in stable condition.
Actually, I kind of still care about that. But the NVIDIA announcement is also interesting. It's a new reference design for Tegra 4 called the Tegra Note. The design supports stylus input, and NVIDIA will include Camera Awesome from Smugbug and even manage Android system updates. Tegra Note tablets should arrive in October from companies like EVGA, PNY, and Zotac. NVIDIA's suggested price is $199, but manufacturers can charge whatever they want.
Windows 8.1 is a free update for Windows 8 users, but if you're running older versions, you'll have to buy an upgrade to the latest edition. The basic Windows 8.1 upgrade edition will cost $119, with the Pro version priced at $199. Windows 8.1 will be offered at retail or via the download option and what the company calls full version software. The change is in response to feedback from people who want to build PCs or run Windows 8.1 in virtual environments. If you buy a copy of Windows 8.1, then it's a full version rather than an upgrade edition. Hopefully that is not confusing.
I'm confused. Tesla has joined the rather large group of companies promising to make self-driving cars. Google is the most famous, of course, but recently Audi, Mercedes, Nissan, Volvo, and GM have all promised to deliver autonomous vehicles at various points between now and the next 10 years. Musk believes he can deliver an autonomous car within 3 years, though a human driver would be required for 10% of the miles driven.
Pandora just won a case in federal court that would allow the company to keep its library of ASCAP songs. Now, a group of songwriters and music publishers were trying to limit the number of songs it would license to Pandora under its 2011 deal and wanted to negotiate license fees directly with web radio services. U.S. District Judge Denise Coate granted Pandora summary judgment because the language of the contract between ASCAP and Pandora, quote, unambiguously requires ASCAP to provide Pandora with a license to perform all of the works in its repertory.
Just so you know, if you're tracking this, my progress bar hasn't moved one bit since I showed you this at the top of the show. And instead of 29 minutes, it now says 4 hours.
My download time
says 3.
I'm not going to be done with this.
Just put your phone in a drawer, shut the drawer, and have lunch after Tech News Today. When you come back, it'll be updated.
I'm going to be doing security now.
Oh.
And as soon as security now is over, this thing is still not going to be updated. But let's thank our sponsor for today's show, Shutterstock. If I needed an image to express my ambivalence and ennui about iOS 7, I could find it because you can search by mood at Shutterstock.com. You'll find the perfect image for any video that you want in your next creative project, whether it's for your website, or whether it's a publication, an advertisement, a video, any type of project, you can find images, 28 million high quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips over there. And they let you choose individual image packs. So if you're like, well, Tom, I need lots of images, you can choose that pack. You can get 25 images a day with the standard subscription. Or if you're like, Tom, I don't need that many images, you download any image in any size, pay only one price. Shutterstock gives you the images you need to bring your creative projects to the next level. And they recently partnered with Facebook to provide advertising customers free access to all its images through Facebook's ad creation tool. That's a great resource for local businesses that want professional looking ads. You also have the light boxes that let you share and collaborate. It's a global marketplace. They're adding new images all the time, and they make sure they're high quality. They review every image. You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. No credit card needed. Just start an account. Begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like and save your favorite images to a light box to review later. Once you decide to purchase, use the offer code TNT9. And new accounts will receive 25% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com for 25% off new accounts. Use that offer code TNT9. We thank Shutterstock for their support of Tech News Today. So go try them out to show your support for the show as well. Joining us now, an old friend of the show, former co-host of mine from the CNET days, and now director of developer relations at Evernote, Mr. Rafe Needleman. Good to have you back on the show, my friend.
Good to be here. A lot of fun.
Are you updating your iOS?
I tried to, but it told me I should plug in because my batteries are a little low. Can I tell you something? This now is a great time for a heist because everybody's updating their phones. Nobody can contact anybody else. I'm making a movie.
The world was brought to its knees by
That's
iOS
right.
7. Let's talk about that, Sarah. Besides the iOS 7 launch happening right now, we got all the embargoed reviews came out and iTunes is updating, all kinds of cool stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, I'd say we were sort of joking before the show that iOS 7 is a big deal. And of course, there are a lot of people who don't use iOS devices who think, boy, you know, these are the days where Apple people are the most annoying. And I really do understand that because it's like, gee, you know, you think there was something actually interesting going on. But iOS 7 is a big deal for anybody who is familiar with iOS because It looks really different. There are a lot of new features, but I think arguably it's the design that's so wildly different. We got new colors, everything's flattened. We've talked about all of this before, but today is the official day. It's no longer a beta. This is the most current stable version of iOS. Of course, there are bound to be issues, so that's something to keep in mind if you, you know, need to use your phone in, you know, critical ways this week. It might be best to wait another week, unless you just have to have the latest and the greatest first like us. But yeah, iTunes 11.1 is also live. I played around with it a little bit this morning, downloaded it on my laptop. You've got iTunes Radio, which is Apple's Pandora competitor. Also some interesting stuff like podcast stations. You can now maybe put together, if you like podcasts a lot, you know, you bundle TNT in with some other tech-related podcasts, and that's something that you can... you can listen to it sort of like a podcast playlist. You can sync with iOS 7. So whatever you've got set up in iTunes on your computer then would propagate on other iOS devices running iOS 7. That's kind of nice. Then you've got a variety of apps that are rolling out to take advantage of iOS 7 and look as native as possible. Yahoo is one of the apps that got a pretty big update. Not only is there... the updated Yahoo logo and just kind of an overall flattened look. But they've got a read later feature. It's almost sort of like Yahoo's own Instapaper, which is sort of your saved stories. They've got integration where you can easily send a story to Tumblr, of course, a Yahoo property. Pandora rolled out its new app. So you're starting to see not just native iOS 7 looking different, but all of the third-party apps rushing to seem like they fit in pretty well. Rafe, what do you think? Do you think iOS 7 is different enough that it'll keep people quiet about how Apple can't innovate, at least for a little while?
Well, I reject your premise that Apple can't innovate. I think iOS 7 is interesting. I mean, obviously, I've been staying on the old stable versions of iOS 6 until today, and I'm not yet updated. But it's a beautiful new operating system. It has a lot of cool stuff in it, not just in the OS, but in, you know, like you said, in iTunes. The innovation that that Apple has here is in its flagship phone, in the motion sensor, in the fingerprint reader, in 64-bit CPU, in the iPhone 5S. That is pretty impressive. That's a pretty impressive power in a mobile platform, and nobody's really going to be taking advantage of it in the short term, but it should allow a new era of really powerful applications. I think it's pretty interesting.
I think it's going to cause quite a debate if there are many applications that don't work. In fact, even if there's just a few big name applications that don't work well or have major bugs. I don't know about you guys, but I had like 39 App Store updates waiting for me on my iPad this morning. And I updated a bunch of them last night. It's just, it's like an avalanche, right?
I think
a lot of this is, I mean, it's, sorry, Rafe, to interrupt you. I think a lot of it is, it's less that the apps are really updated at all. It's just that they want the perception from the public that, ooh, new iOS 7 enabled. I mean, often this is just a little bit of a logo change.
Well, the apps are all being updated with new design. I mean, Apple is trying to change the design language for phones, again, as it did when it launched the phone the first time. And, you know, it's not quite flat. It's not skeuomorphic. It's this new kind of layered, multicolored Johnny Ivy logo look. And it's incredibly impressive that Apple can force a wholesale change of the aesthetic of pretty much every single app that matters across the board. Like, Tom, like you, I've had over the last couple of days, every single one of my apps pretty much has been updated, all getting iOS 7 ready. And that just shows the power that Apple has to change the way we perceive technology. So I think it's a big deal. I think it will change the way we all interact with our phones, and it changes the design language. I mean, how many other companies even Microsoft didn't change the way most people interact with their old Windows app. Apple is changing the way we all interact with our smartphone apps.
I think one of the other bigger things, other than that facelift, we're seeing all the different colors and things, that's going to be the first thing people see. There's a ton of like API access that Apple didn't originally give. So there's all these apps that are not necessarily just getting updates for the looks. They're going to be able to do like real true multitasking. You're going to have updates in the background. iOS 7 is supposed to handle that a little neater than the old iOS versions. So even though we have all of this glitz and this new color scheme, I'm really curious about how these apps are really going to take advantage of those APIs that are now available to developers.
And you know, one of the most interesting things here is that this is like you're watching a NASCAR race or any auto race, and all of a sudden there's a yellow flag, and all the competitors have to bunch up in the starting line for the restart. This reset that Apple is putting on us with iOS 7 is basically having every competitor in the app space bunch up on the starting line, and now it's a new race. It's kind of an interesting way to reset the whole playing field.
I'm going to have to refuel, too. Ethan pointed out in the chat room that this is the last time I will have to deal with that app update because, frankly, they don't do that in iOS 7. It just automatically happens.
Because of John McCain.
You can't avoid bad app updates like happened with the Google Authenticator.
Two hours remaining.
I keep going back and forth. I'm at 13 minutes, but like the last time I looked 2 seconds ago, I was 20 minutes. And remember, it was 4 hours, not that. Anyway, it's crazy.
Can we just go back
to about YouTube?
Okay.
YouTube doing offline viewing. So, in other words, starting in November, according to this blog post they put up, when you go to YouTube, you can choose certain videos, and they haven't quite detailed how this works. So maybe your subscription videos can automatically do this, but you'll be able to have your videos available for offline viewing. All Things D says up to 48 hours. Google didn't say that in the blog post, but apparently they have a source. This has been a big problem for people who do podcasting or people who are used to podcasting, used to listening or watching podcasts in YouTube land to make a transition because we're used to watching these things wherever we want, on a plane or out running without having to stream them. Rafe, do you think this will be enough to bridge this divide? Will this kind of change the landscape? Will it open up YouTube to a whole new audience?
Well, I think people who want to see YouTube are seeing it right now. So this will help us for the commuters, basically, right? So you're going on a subway, and you happen to be one of the few subways left in the world where you don't have a signal. This will let you continue your shows. I think that's a good thing. You know, YouTube will continue to track and serve ads, and then telephone back to the servers what ads are watched. So it's kind of a necessary and obvious move in media. We're still not at the point where we should be by now, where if there's something I want to watch, I can watch it on whatever device I happen to have, whether I'm online or off, and things are just handled. I mean, right now, if you're trying to come up with things to watch on YouTube and Netflix and Hulu and whatever, you still got to remember what channel you're on, just like the old days when you had to remember what channel the show was on. Now you have to remember what service things are on, and I'm kind of tired of that. And maybe this is a move towards making that better, but I think we still have a long way to go.
This reminds me back when Microsoft came out with their first YouTube app for Windows Phone, and they had the ability to download YouTube videos. Obviously, not exactly the same as this because the Google app will just get rid of the video after a while. It's an interesting move for YouTube. There's always these hacks to try to download videos or audio right from YouTube. Maybe with this kind of thing, if they actually somewhat support this, where you do have that little dropout on your commute or something, maybe that'll stop people from downloading things from YouTube because they want those views, right? They want those counts. They want to be able to say we have millions and millions of eyeballs, and if this is the way they're going to do it, it might work out for them long term.
And there have been lots of apps that have been able to do this. It's just this is officially coming from Google. Go ahead, sir.
Well, yeah, I totally agree with you, Tom. This is the whole offline watching video thing. It's not like YouTube's making this up. But YouTube is the big video site, and if we're trained to get past the point where we say, ooh, well, you can only I'm underground and on my subway train type of thing. I can't watch YouTube videos right now. Once we start not having that conversation, then that's a great thing because then you're just watching more YouTube videos. So I think it's a great feature. It's probably not something that I'm going to take advantage of really because on my commute I have to drive and I can't watch videos. But yeah, I think a lot of people are just going to like this feature.
Chicken and Egg in the chat room wonders how Microsoft is feeling since Microsoft was trying to make this happen in their version of a YouTube app and Google stopped them. And it's all about advertising. It's all about counting advertising. So all those independent apps that have been doing this for a long time, Microsoft's and others, weren't playing with the advertising the way Google wants. And that 48 hours is indicative of that because they don't want that ad to age. They don't want you to watch this weeks later. And that's why I don't think this is going to be very good for getting people who aren't used to YouTube over to YouTube because they're going to be like, well, I want to watch it 72 hours later, right? I download a podcast. Sometimes I don't listen to it until the next week, right? I don't want that to expire. It's just not enough, I don't think, to really bridge that particular gap.
Do you think, Tom, that this could be the beginning of that the 48-hour window will be expanded and then become, you know, a week and then a month and perpetual, and then YouTube will eventually take on the more traditional streaming video services?
No, because I don't think I will, unless they can figure out a way to count the ads or replace the ads efficiently. Mm-hmm. I think that's the big holdup. They're going to have to change their attitude to that for that to happen. Let's talk about Microsoft getting into the TV business, making television shows. YouTube's doing downloads. Microsoft's making original TV shows. And it's not just the Halo show, right?
Yeah, there's a lot more coming apparently in the pipeline. So Bloomberg's reporting that Microsoft is working on expanding its TV programming beyond that Halo series. Microsoft discussed that Halo series that's going to have Steven Spielberg involved. It's coming to the Xbox One. Phil Spencer, corporate vice president at Microsoft Studios, said, "They have literally hundreds of ideas they're incubating right now." He's talking about the production team. We will have some new announcements for TV shows coming pretty soon. There's also going to be some Xbox One exclusive television content unrelated to games. Spencer said that he thinks there's going to be a certain level of interactivity on those TV shows. Spencer calls these TV projects Nancy projects in reference to Nancy Tellum.
Because Nancy, like an insult.
It's not, because Nancy Tellum was the former head of CBS Television Studios, who is now the head of Microsoft Entertainment and Digital Media. She's a big champion of content for television content for the Xbox One. So Microsoft also has that partnership with the NFL for exclusive highlights and game scores. Rafe, it used to be that the exclusive games, the game titles, would get people locked to a console or a hardware box. Is original video content going to be that same hook to get people to go, I'm going to pick the Xbox One over the PS4 because I want to watch that Spielberg show?
Yeah, I don't think it's any one thing. I don't think that videos will make people or TV shows will make people choose a console over another console. But it's a package. I mean, consoles are not just one thing. They're entertainment hubs, games, video content, etc. So you kind of need the whole suite of content to make them attractive. It is, though, I think a sort of interesting and a possibly dangerous move to try to create a video series that is not related to the other entertainment, the game entertainment things, because it's expensive to create good consumer content. And if the only people who can watch it are people who have the console, and you think that people are going to buy the console because they can watch that TV show, that is probably a troubling proposition. But you need entertainment of all stripes in order to sell a console these days. You can't just do games. You can't just do video. You can't just do interactive content. You've got to do all of it.
I would be a little more positive on Microsoft being able to sway people into buying an Xbox One because a show they want to watch is available on there if you didn't also have to pay to watch the show. Now, I don't know. They may make these available outside of Xbox Live, but right now you have to have an Xbox Live Gold subscription to do pretty much anything other than play a video game on the Xbox. And if you're going to have to pay a subscription fee to your Xbox One in order to watch the TV show, if you're not already buying the Xbox, then all this does is maybe increase the loyalty of people who already were going to get an Xbox One and already were going to pay for Xbox Live Gold because they wanted to play online games.
It seems like it's a curiosity to me that Microsoft's going into the production business as opposed to licensing things. The NFL deal makes sense to me. They don't have to make the content so much as they get it, and they'll have an exclusive, and that gets people's eyeballs. But to be bankrolling productions of other shows and to potentially have hundreds of programming ideas, that seems like it's a real shift as opposed to just licensing. So I'm not really sure if Microsoft can be successful with that, because if this one box has everything, now you have to buy this box to watch this content. Are you going to have water cooler talk? How do you have people discuss these things to have viewership grow?
Well, you've got to get the box has to do more. Obviously, the box has to do more than just Microsoft's own content. So they need to have the client for all the other streaming apps, and then it becomes the hub of all entertainment. So I don't know what the Xbox has right now, but whether, you know, Hulu, Amazon, Netflix, etc. Probably it has almost everything now or soon will, except iTunes. And then you can just replace your entertainment system with this one box. And that's actually kind of cool. The subscription thing might be an issue, but if you can displace other services, then slowly you can start to move content from those services onto your service as well and off to the races.
My iPhone has gone into the preparing update.
That's why the conversation on this show is so stilted today. It's because, like, yeah.
Everybody software except for me, by the way.
Who said the conversation was stilted, Rafe?
What are you talking about?
Oh, sorry. What were you saying?
Let's take a break and let me tell you a little bit about our other sponsor for today's show, ProXPN. One of the first things I installed when I replaced my hard drive and started fresh on my MacBook Pro was ProXPN, because I wanted to be able to pretend I was in Chicago. And I'm not going to tell you why, but you can do that. In fact, ProXPN is a global VPN that works with almost any internet connection, creates a secure encrypted tunnel. All your online data passes through a 512-bit encryption tunnel, works with OpenVPN or PPTP, you choose. It bypasses internet filtering, bypasses blocked sites. But really, most importantly, what it does is secures you against prying eyes on those open Wi-Fi access points. When you're at the coffee shop, when you're at the airport, when you're at the hotel, those things are wide open. And there's lots of documented things about these apps that people use to sniff the traffic and see what you're posting on Facebook, maybe intercept your password, unless you've got HTTPS, which you should, but you also should be running VPN to just make sure nothing that you're sending out to that Wi-Fi network can be seen outside of your 512-bit encryption tunnel. And you can configure ProXPN like any VPN, because it's OpenVPN or PPTP for anything, and you can use it on Linux. But there's a new ProXPN app for Android in the Google Play Store that supports OpenVPN, makes it easy. And there's apps for iOS. There's apps for your laptop. You got to try it out there, because there's Windows and Mac advanced controls allowing you to select the programs and ports you want to anonymously route through your ProXPN servers. World-class customer support. Even Steve Gibson from Security Now likes it. That's good enough for me. Go to proxpn.com/twit. For more information and to sign up. ProXPN premium accounts are normally $9.95 a month or $74.95 for an entire year, but we got a special offer. Use the code TNT to receive 20% off for the lifetime of your account. That's less than $5 a month on the yearly plan. And if you're not satisfied, you can cancel within 7 days for a full refund. So go to proxpn.com/twit and sign up with the code TNT. We thank ProXPN for their support of Tech News Today. Google is changing things in the cookie world for tracking you for ads. See what you think of this, by the way. Digital Advertising Alliance has withdrawn from the Do Not Track effort. It's still, I mean, they still got the Internet Advertising Bureau. It's still working over there on it, but it doesn't look like we're going to get agreement on Do Not Track anytime soon. So these independent efforts are especially important to keep track of. An anonymous source told the USA Today that Google Ad ID would supposedly replace cookies, third-party cookies, and give users more privacy and control. So Google plans to reach out to industry participants, to government bodies, consumer groups, try to get them on board with this. Now, remember, Safari and Firefox already block third-party cookies because they say it's just there's too much privacy violation going on there. Instead of managing it, we're just going to block them. Ad ID is, I think, Google's way to say, in Chrome, we're going to split the difference. You can reset once a year. Browsers will do this and give you a chance to just kind of start over from scratch. A secondary ad ID could be used for private sessions, so you can protect your privacy in a particular session that's not one of those incognito sessions, just a secondary session. And advertisers would have to adhere to the program terms and give users the ability to customize a list of approved advertisers. Now, we don't know whether Google would just use this in Chrome or whether they would make it a standard that other people could also use. It's just a leak in the USA Today. But, Rafe, I think the question here is, do we want Google to be in charge of tracking advertising? They already have a lot of our information.
That is the question. Google could probably technically do a more secure, technically more private tracking system and technically give advertisers more protected information, groups of information, collecting people by bucket instead of individual. Technically, I'm sure they could do that because they have, you know, they are controlling the flow of information between the user and the internet through Google and their browsers. But do we want Google to have all that information? Do we really trust Google to collect everything that we do online, even more than we are right now, and be not just collecting that information, but now be the gateway of advertising dollars? It's I mean, there's a lot of both good and potentially problematical things with having Google replace a more open advertising tracking system with one that is, I'm not going to say controlled by, but managed or run exclusively by Google. I see it as a giant congressional problem, even if it is technically better and even if Google's protocols and protections are arguably stronger than what we have right now with more open systems.
Yeah, replacement, you would think you want like a consortium involved. You want a lot of different companies trying to put something together because Google's done a couple of trust breaches when it comes to picking up all kinds of data with its Street View vans or its trucks or cars anyway. And then we've had issues with being opted into Buzz, all kinds of privacy concerns that have come up from Google. And the fact they make a lot of money in advertising, the idea that they would have such a great way to take that data and help their own ad business, that I think is just generally, that's the first instinct of having fear when it comes to this. But if Google's system is good and their motto was do no evil, then they could go out and they can either open source this or go, hey, look, we're going to be part of a consortium and let us write this with you guys.
Yeah, if the consortium will last, which so far they haven't, and then Google will end up basically being the strong man in the consortium and running it anyway. So they'll try. And I'm sure in this case, it's both good. Again, the potential is this is could be good for privacy and also very good for Google. It probably is going to be seen as anti-competitive when it comes to the advertising market. And if I were in the advertising industry, I'm not sure that I would want Google to have even more power and control of information than it has already. So any effort that Google can make to consolidate information through its products, I think is going to be met with a lot of resistance, no matter how good it is.
Yeah, I think I would like to see this done as an industry initiative that is an open standard. Get everybody on board to this. Maybe Google is driving the process, but they're not owning the process. And that way you don't have Google dominating it and everything going through Google servers, except in so much as we all just happen to use Google products, which is already happening already. Meanwhile, Google wants to actually own all the power. They're power hungry, Sarah.
Yeah, Google has actually purchased outright an entire wind farm, about 240 megawatt wind farm outside of Amarillo, Texas, which is expected to start producing energy in over a year, late 2014. It's called Happy Hereford. It's owned by Kermac Energy, which is based in Oklahoma, which happens to be on the same grid as Google's Mays County, Oklahoma data center, which is a huge data center, requires a lot of power. So this wind farm will provide energy to the Southwest power pool that Google's data farm is a part of, but other things are too. What's interesting about this, a couple things. First of all, it's not an investment. We've talked in the past about Google investing many millions of dollars into a variety of wind farms. There was a 50 megawatt wind farm that they put $75 million into, $200 million into a 161 megawatt facility. At the end of 2012, all of Google's renewable energy products were capable of generating an estimated 2 gigawatts of power. So this is definitely something that Google has been taken seriously. However, this particular wind farm is interesting because they can't actually take the energy produced by the wind farm and put it directly into the data center that needs the power. There are restrictions about this. The way that Google describes it is, and this is the post explaining the purchase, quote, after purchasing the renewable energy, we'll retire the renewable energy credits called RECs and sell the energy itself to the wholesale market. So they're going to put it back in the grid. We'll apply any additional RECs produced under this agreement to reduce our carbon footprint elsewhere. I did a bunch of reading up on RECs and it's so complicated. We can't get too far into that right now. But basically, an REC is a tradable, non-tangible energy commodity here in the U.S. that represents proof, basically, that a 1 megawatt hour of electricity was generated from some sort of renewable energy source that has been deemed eligible, and it sort of varies state by state. Once in the grid, renewable energy is impossible to separate from the conventionally generated energy, though. So Google's basically got this wind farm. You go, oh, great, awesome. But wind energy is extremely variable. You know, it all depends on the wind, right? So this all goes into the grid, but you can't separate it back out. So Google can't say, well, our server farm now runs completely on wind because it just doesn't work that way. Rafe, is this like a good for the planet thing, or is this just Google saying, listen, we want to do something that's good for our data center?
Yeah, let me put on my
PhD in energy economics.
We'll get a little Skype interference, and you just sound like you're throwing out letters.
He's just spelling it out for us. That's probably it. It's just clearly.
I've stumped him with RECs. He may have read the same Wikipedia article I did this morning.
Too many acronyms. Yeah.
Am I back with
you? What do you think? Sorry, Tom.
I think Rafe's back. There we go.
Am I back? Good.
Oh, yeah, you're back. Okay.
Sorry, I was talking so fast, I overloaded Skype. I have no idea. I was saying, you know, I don't have a PhD in energy economics. I find it amusing, though, that in Texas, of all places, Google just can't stick a couple of windmills on top of their server farm and say, our servers, our energy, you know, whatever. I understand that there's a lot of carbon trading or carbon footprint trading economics that goes on here. Ultimately, when you are sucking down such a large amount of any commodity in order to make your business work, it helps if you control some of the supply and flow of that commodity so that you can buffer the variability of the pricing that you otherwise wouldn't be in control of. I think that's all that is here for Google, both in terms of pricing of energy and pricing in terms of the carbon trading equivalent. So it's probably just a strictly economic move that makes a lot of sense to even out Google's expenses.
I don't know. Google sometimes seems altruistic, right? The idea of trying to have a zero carbon footprint, it's good for PR and everything, but Google doesn't want to necessarily have servers that suck down lots of power. They're trying to redesign those things. We've heard Facebook doing the same things with servers, trying to get them to be lower energy. So until Google can go ahead and build these windmills or using those bloom boxes, these different kinds of technologies to get energy, to make the energies cheaper or make it more efficient, until they can do that, buying these credits seems like a good move. I did say before, the privacy concerns about Google, I think for the most part, they're not trying to be evil. They just like to make money. So this kind of is in line with both.
All right, let's finish you off with Adobe. Photoshop's still very successful. There are lots of numbers recently about how successful it is. But a lot of people think, well, what's Adobe going to do? Because Flash is, you know, pretty much on its way out. Looks like they're going to make hardware, Ayaz.
Yeah, so back in May, Adobe showed off Project Mighty and Project Napoleon. These were two devices, hardware devices. One's a stylus that uses Bluetooth that measures pressure sensitivity. It works on an iPad. There's a small ruler called Project Napoleon, get it? Small ruler, that's an awesome name, that will project digital lines on your iPad so you can draw these straight lines and curves and all kinds of things that way with the hardware. And Adobe has announced these devices are coming out in 2014, at least the first half. They didn't give an exact date. They didn't give an exact price of either one. But according to Michael Goff, Adobe's vice president of experience design, he says, we have no intention of becoming a hardware company. We're doing the minimum amount of hardware necessary to be a better software company. Rafe, Adobe's moved from box software to subscription-based services, and now we're looking at an entry into hardware of next year. Do you buy this minimum hardware argument?
Well, I think that drawing tools for Adobe make a lot of sense. If these products help to sell their services, their software, in whatever form it is, I think that makes that just is kind of an obvious thing to do. I mean, these days, you can make a software product more attractive if you have some cool gizmo that goes with it. I still don't quite get the ruler. I mean, when you're working on a tablet and a computer device, and you want to draw a straight line, you tap the beginning and you tap the end and it becomes a straight line. It's not like tracing with a pencil. That seems kind of archaic to me, but so I'm sure I'm missing something there. But it's also interesting, I think, what's happening now with pens. I mean, it appears to me, based on the NVIDIA Tegra tablet news and this news and some other stuff that's coming along, that in some ways, styluses and pens may be making a bit of a comeback, not just for professional artists and designers. And I find that very curious after about 10 years of complete failure in the consumer pen market.
When it comes to that ruler, like I used to draw a lot when I was a kid. I wanted to be a comic artist, so I drew with actual like pencils and paper. Right. And there's something about trying to recreate that with the stylus. It's just there's always this little lag when it comes to the line being drawn. If you're using that ruler, when I first heard that too, I thought it was a little strange. But watching the demo video and seeing, because we ran that, if you're watching the video version, The way it works, it's just much more natural if you're used to working with pen and paper. I think that's really the hook. I think the pricing could make or break that, because if that ruler is going to cost like $200, that seems ridiculous. It's Bluetooth enabled, so it can actually project those lines for you. It's an interesting idea to try to recreate the tools that an artist is used to, instead of having to force them to relearn everything. But I wonder how long that demographic is going to exist, because people might be starting to draw on tablets now as opposed to like when I was a kid with pencil and paper.
If you're a professional artist of any stripe, whether it's drawing or photography or writing or whatever, and you're trying to survive as a professional and make money in today's world, and your customers and clients are moving to digital, then you're learning digital technologies today, because it is absolutely critical that you do so in order to stay current. So and fine arts is a different matter, but in commercial arts, you've got to use the current tools.
I agree with that, but I also think, I mean, we're recreating the concept of like, yes, a paper, a pencil, and a ruler in a very expensive way. I think this is very cool. I think, if you're a professional, these are the sorts of tools that you not only have to know about, but you have to know how to use. And eventually, this will be the way that things work. But right now, I mean, it's a little silly. It's, you know, you're talking hundreds of dollars to recreate something that isn't really broken. We're just digitizing it.
If I were an actual artist, if I could even draw anything more than bad stick figures, and boy, do I draw bad stick figures, I probably would be very excited about this. That idea of the ruler that can snap to a horizontal line just seems fantastic to me. On the other hand, I have no idea whether that's really helpful or not, because I don't draw. And maybe people say, well, no, that's actually not that useful. I want to be able to control that. But these do seem like the kinds of things that will add to the ability to efficiently make better drawings. And yes, you can still do pen and paper if you want and scan it in. And I don't think people will ever stop doing that. I think that's like saying, oh, well, now that we have pencils, we don't need pens anymore. And now we don't need paint anymore. And people are still going to do those things. It's just another tool in the toolbox, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things about things like iPads is that they don't have built-in pressure sensitivity like a Wacom tablet or one of those things. So that's why you need to have these Bluetooth devices that can do that can detect pressure sensitivity. And that pen that they're making, Project Mighty, is actually being made by Adenit, who actually makes the Jot tablet stylus. So they have experience doing this. It's going to be a modified design. It's we've seen Samsung devices can actually handle the pressure sensitivity. It'd be interesting if Apple decided at some point to say, wait a second, if artists are using this and they're using Styli for this, why doesn't our device support pressure sensitivity? Because if this is going to be a tool for them, why not give them that feature?
All right. We're really close to the randomizer, but if you want to check in on my personal install going on, rebooting right now, fingers crossed.
That's so exciting.
Is that a Galaxy?
Knock on wood. Just watch that thing. Oh, is it actually going to reboot right there? Look at that.
Yes.
Oh,
my God.
Oh, the Apple logo is not colorful. I thought that was going to be...
Maybe it will actually totally hit here in a second. But meanwhile, the randomizer. it's going. There we go. All right, the randomizer today, we had a live straw poll for our live audience. Structure sensor that uses iPads to scan 3D objects got 15% of the vote. A girl scoring with immersive Mario-themed bedroom got 39% of the vote. But the winner... BBC reporter confuses paper pad, stack of A9 paper, for iPad and refuses to acknowledge mistake, just keeps going at 45%. You can see he's holding a ream of paper there. And I presume, I haven't checked this out, that normally the host would just be holding an iPad. But he's just, you know, he's holding that letter-sized paper as he does his drunk tank story.
Are we sure that he doesn't have like the world's coolest iPad case that if you left it somewhere, nobody would steal it?
Because they just think it's a pad of paper?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like one of those like bookcases where you hide jewels.
Well, I mean,
it's like his security blanket, you know? He's like, I don't have an iPad, but I have to feel like I have one in order to deliver this news.
I don't know what to do with my hands. It's just like, paper.
Yeah, maybe he wasn't confusing. Everybody's like, he confuses it with an iPad. I think it's less likely that he thought he was holding an iPad, although I guess it's possible. And that he was just like, oh, crap, I can't find the iPad, but I'm going to look weird if I don't. Like, what do I do with my hands? I'll just grab this. It was the nearest thing. And it was a bad idea. But that's kind of what I think happened.
Or he lost a bet.
Maybe. Maybe someone stole his iPad and swapped that in right before the camera
went
on. But
the headline, I thought it was like somebody was like pinching and zooming a pad of paper or something. He's just holding it. It's not like it's that big a deal.
Yeah, he's just holding a pad of paper in front of him. Well, not a pad, like a whole ream. And still wrapped, by the way. Like an unopened ream of paper. Is that a ream? Ream's less than, that's less than a ream.
He's saving time because right when he's done on TV, he's going to go to the printer and he's going to load it in. So,
maybe he was refilling the paper like a good citizen. Exactly. And then he was like, you got to be on air right now. And he just ran over. I didn't thought about that. Let's see what's on the calendar, Sarah.
Okay. Internet Explorer 11 for Windows 7 has entered release preview. The official release date is October 18th. Sony's PlayStation 4 is going to go on sale not in Japan first. In fact, in December, Singapore, Hong Kong, Malaysia, Taiwan, and South Korea will all get the PlayStation 4. Japanese customers have to wait until February 22nd, 2014, in a bizarre turn of events.
Yeah, crazy. Let's see what's incoming.
Incoming message.
We got a message from, I don't know, Mox. That's what I'll say. Hey, TNTers, in episode 841, you read a message from Derek in which he claims the QWERTY keyboard was designed to slow typists. This is a common myth, but the Smithsonian provides contrary evidence. In a 2011 paper, the researchers tracked the evolution of the typewriter keyboard alongside a record of its early professional users. They conclude that the mechanics of the typewriter did not influence the keyboard design. Rather, the QWERTY system emerged as a result of how the first typewriters were being used. Turns out QWERTY was actually designed to make typing faster, at least for the telegraph typers. So controversy over when it comes to QWERTY keyboards. No one will ever wonder about this.
This happens from time to time, and I kind of love it, where we like read an email with somebody, and then somebody's like, no, that's not the way it works. And it's one of these kind of cool but niche topics like typewriters, and I think this is great. Thank you, Mox. NMAWCS, and citing the Smithsonian Magazine. That's good. That's awesome good stuff. Work. Yeah.
Got another email from George who says, I was thinking about the discussion about Bump, about a particular use case. What I'd always wished Bump could be used for was seamlessly transitioning either video or web browsing from your mobile device to your TV or your computer. Imagine using your mobile device to watch a movie, and then you walk into your house and you want to watch it on your TV. All you have to do is bump your cell phone on the TV and then continue to watch where you left off and vice versa. There could be a similarly easy transition between phone and computer while browsing the web that would be fantastic. Of course, Google tries to accomplish this with web browsing, but they could make it seamless with Bump technology. Isn't that like...
That was like the Nexus Q.
You guys do know where Bump technology is really needed. I read this somewhere. Did you talk about in auto accidents? When two cars collide, they immediately share information when they bump.
The Google self-driving cars are going to integrate Bump. You're right.
Although in those situations, the bump could take the form of more of a punch.
Yeah.
I have a feel.
Like a crunch, yeah.
Yeah.
That's why they call them bumpers, after all.
I'm sorry, George. It's probably just me, but I just don't see the advantage to having to walk over to my television and hit it with something to make it do something.
Maybe you're not thinking like the old school days when your TV didn't work and you smacked it on the side for it to work. Didn't do anything, but like if you could do that with your phone, I want this show over there. Whack.
They showed this off at Google I/O a few years ago, right? With the before, I think it was the year before the Nexus Q was unveiled. It was the Android at Home, the official unveiling, where it was the stereo system. And they're like, see, we put the CD next to it and it starts playing. Still haven't really seen it.
But they didn't hit it. Yeah, you're right, though. It's just similar. Well, that is it for us today. Thank you so much for watching us. Thank you for joining us, Rafe Needleman of Evernote. I hear the Evernote event of the year is coming up.
It is. And the lights just went off in this room because they're an emotion sensor. And I'm not even going to get up and change them. Can you still see me?
Yeah, we can see you.
All right. So coming up, I'm very excited about this. The whole of Evernote is working towards the Evernote conference, which is coming up September 26th and 27th in San Francisco. We're going to have great speakers there. We've got the founders of Feedly and Pocket. We've got Dave Weiner, one of the pioneers of RSS. Chris Anderson of 3D Robotics, former editor-in-chief of Wired is speaking. Wow. David Allen of Getting Things Done. And awesome new announcements about Evernote. I have to mention that. If you want to go, use the special Friends of Rafe discount code for 30% off tickets. Go to bit.ly/ecrafe30. That's bit.ly/ecrafe30, all lowercase. And come see all the cool stuff that we're going to be doing at the Evernote conference and everything that this company has been doing for the last year, all in 2 days.
That's a pretty great list of guests, I have to say. Those are
going to be really, really fun.
No doubt. Yeah. And I like that you just gave everybody a Friend of Rafe discount. That's pretty awesome. Thank you for doing that.
My pleasure.
Awesome. Check it out. Evernote.com. Thank you, folks, for submitting stories at our subreddit at technewstoday.reddit.com. That is the place to go if you would like to let us know what stories you want to do. I want to know, we got like 18,000 people in there. We look at that subreddit probably like for the most part about 2 hours, hour and a half, 2 hours before the show. So get your votes in like 3 or 4 hours before the show if you really want it to have the biggest effect. I noticed a story yesterday that had 0 votes yesterday when we did the show, and then it had 98 votes by the end of yesterday. It's kind of an old story by this morning. So technewstoday.reddit.com. We appreciate all the interaction there no matter what. You can also find us on the web at twit.tv/TNT. You can email us. Our email address is tnt@twit.tv. And you can give us a call, leave us a voicemail. Our phone number is 260-TNT-SHOW. My update is not over yet. So if you want to know, you can listen to the entirety of today's show while you update your iPhone. We'll see you tomorrow with Chris O'Brien from the LA Times as our guest.